Ray Charles's musical director before he embarked on a solo career in the world of hard bop, jazz funk, and soul jazz. That's Hank Crawford on alto sax with Mr. Blues. It's from his award-winning 14th album, and he had several others besides. That album was titled Wild Flower and released in 1973 and released again in 2016. So popular was it. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And you know where all roads lead on Sunday, March 11th? Yes, you do. At 1:30, you should be seated in the Community Church of New York at 40 East 35th Street. That's off Park Avenue. I'm going to be there, and a whole bunch of listeners are going to be there, and we're all going to look each other in the face and shake some hands and do some hugging, and we're going to just have a great time getting to meet each other personally and just chatting a bit. It's the way we would be expanding our community through Lead Stories, and I hope you'll be there. Bring somebody else with you and kind of show off a bit. So this is where I am every single day at 1 o'clock. This is the person who has messed with my mind. All right. So I'm looking forward to seeing you this Sunday at 1:30 p.m. at the Community Church of New York, 40 East 35th Street off Park Avenue. But this is Lead Stories today. And, you know, this is your time, exclusively your time. We talk to each other every day, but this is the day when you decide what you want to talk about and you decide what's important, what we should be considering. And you, of course, are giving us your considered opinions as you do so. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. And we're going to start today with Jay from New York. Hello, Jay.
Hello, Eutrice. How are you today? Are you feeling well, Al?
I'm sorry. I'm not hearing you too well.
Are you feeling well, I hope?
Yes, I'm hanging in here.
Good. Listen, I was just calling in reference to what you thought about South Africa and the taking back of the land from the whites and giving it to the indigenous people of Africa that the land was taken from. You know, my only hope is that when they take back the land, like they did in Zimbabwe, they have people that could work the land, cultivate the land, and grow the land instead of just taking it back for taking it back's sake. I think that was one of the mistakes that happened when Mugabe did it in Zimbabwe. You just, because it causes too many problems in regards to how it's put out on the world stage. So I'm just hoping that, you know, when they take back the land, they give it to farmers who know how to work the land and grow it. And I mean, maybe they could, you know, get in contact with people from America that are farmers that could maybe go there and help cultivate the land. Because, you know, it's a vast amount of land that needs to be, you know, cultivated and so that they can grow products and things of that nature for the people. So,
well,
I'm
is
really
not as simple as that.
About it.
I mean, it's not as simple. You outline a simple and straightforward idea and plan. The first thing we have to recognize is that that is a decision that belongs within the country, and it belongs within the people's right to decide what to do. Land is the basis of all nationhood. It's not just land that you can farm,
right,
and so forth. You know, it is the basis of nationhood. So we have to see this in the first case as the land was taken or stolen by invaders,
right,
and kept in their possession through force, essentially. These lands were the prizes of warfare against,
right,
these countries. So, in a sense, it's not just reclaiming the land, it is reestablishing nationhood. And it's a very complicated process because now you have to decide what is going to be the future of the country, not just the land, but the country. Where is the country going? And then how will the return of land fit into the larger scheme of things? We don't know. We do know that many countries that have come through colonialism are so corrupt. They're so bogged down with a post-colonial world in which they're still paying tribute to their masters, and they haven't yet come into the fullness of their own identities. And this is a big problem. So the land issue is intertwined with a whole bunch of other issues, and they will have to struggle through it, and I think they will. In South Africa, for example, we have hundreds, we're talking centuries here, of stolen land that then was abused, and in some cases, of course, used for profit, tremendous profit, for the people who stole the land. It is not just about farming. It's about the mineral wealth that comes from the land. It is about the right, the definition of citizenship is determined by where you happen to be on this land. So it's a very, very difficult thing.
Yeah, but the thing is, you treat...
You know, your phone is going in and out and in and out.
Can you hear me better? The thing,
yes,
is that you have to start somewhere. And I think the process is you reclaim the land, but you have to show the invader, the conqueror, that you can work the land to take back the argument that you don't have a right to reclaim the land because you let it go to waste. But I understand your point. It's much broader. But you just can't take the land and not do the right thing by the land. And once you show the invader in the world that you can do the right thing with the land, then you can move forward on the other levels of, you know, reclaiming more of the assets that were taken and stolen from you by the invader. But
I don't think you have to show the invader anything. They're not compelled to do that.
Don't.
They don't have an obligation to do that. They have an obligation only to be self-determining people. That's why they are a nation. And a nation is empowered to make its own rules, and a nation should be making those rules wisely. But the time has long since gone when people should be concerned about what the invaders feel and how you compensate invaders who take your land, take your people to work the land, take the profits from the land. Oh, I have no sympathy there. I think the most important thing we need to watch for is a wise approach, that involves the people. What do they think they ought to do with the land? The threat of reinvasion is always there. It has always been. So it is not going to be a surprise that this will not go down well when people reclaim their land and with it, their rights to the land. And with that, the determination of who should own this land and how this land is to be used. That is a very daunting task. And believe me, the piece of it that we should never discount is the threat, the military threat to reassert the rights of the settlers to own land.
But you know something, I'll leave with this, Utrice. That is always in the back of my mind. And in South Africa, I think that could happen more quickly than we expect, because they still control the military. They still control the mineral wealth of the country. They still control the real true power positions that determine these things. Just because you have a African face as the president, that doesn't mean that they are not in the position to make a move whenever they feel like it to do what they've done before. And, you know, like you said, we have to keep abreast of this. We have to keep that in our sight, and we have to understand that it could happen. And
has happened here, and it continues to happen here in the United States. How much land in North Carolina and Georgia and other parts south has just been just taken away? I've done stories.
Yeah, but they
about
don't
it.
Do it. They don't do it as violently as they will in South Africa. There's a big difference between the violence of South Africa and the manipulation of the land in America, how they reclaim it through taxes and, you know, all sorts of other shenanigans. In South Africa, they will use the gun to reclaim the land if it gets to that point. But listen, enjoy your program on Sunday, and I hope that, you know, a lot of people come out and meet and greet you. You know what I mean? And you take care of yourself.
Thanks so much for your call today. Sonia from Florida, you're on the air.
Therese, it's wonderful hearing your voice.
You. Same for you.
I noticed that you scoff when people call you professor. I'm gonna go a little further and call you doctor.
Oh, my Lord.
Because many times in different things that you say, your research, the information you give, it relieves much of the anxiety, among other things. So, Dr. Utrice Lead, it's wonderful talking to you.
Thank you.
Now, I'm calling regarding, you had a listener last month, and he mentioned about leaving the United States. He said that's the solution. I go along with that. However, before that happens, there has to be information and education. People have to first find out what's available in Africa, because much of the land has been ruined, and some of it has been sold. So they would first have to find out what's available. My dream has been that those that are able to go or want to go will take a ship, and the ship will make local stops in Britain and in Italy and get back some of the things that were stolen from Africa. People have to learn not only about the country, but the language. And I have started in that regard. I've contacted some retired educators before I left to go on vacation. And one lady, they're both retired educators. And one woman, her home is a museum. She's been all over Africa, Brazil. And I spoke to her before I left. And the other woman is an Israelite. So when I heard, what was his name? He mentioned on your show that we should learn Chinese. That kind of threw me for a loop. I said, well, I was thinking of getting tapes, so I'll have to see about that. Because if I got tapes in other languages and start having small classes in different homes, and perhaps this can be duplicated in other neighborhoods, and start teaching the children, the preschoolers, start with them. And gradually, if we can do this in every community, things should start to change. So that is that's one of the things that keep me going.
And let me ask
cope.
You.
Certainly.
This, you are reorienting yourself.
Yes.
Why?
Because this, I have to. That keeps me going. And this country with the make-believe, their make-believe history, is stressful. And I know eventually that many people will be leaving here because you're not really living here. You're existing in this make-believe society. And that's why I'm reinventing myself. At my age, I'm reinventing myself. You mentioned a book.
What was the definitive turning point for you? What made you, what was in your mind, what was the deciding point where you said, well, you know what, this is what I have to do?
Years ago, learning what they call history and the lies that they give you and the research that had been done by many of the journalists, where the more you hear and the more you see and the more you read, you realize that this is all make-believe. You know, they tell the medical students that Socrates is the father of invention. No, the father of medicine. And it was Imhotep. And then reading, going on trips with Dr. Ben and reading some of the books from many of the writers, listening to the school children, the high school children, that are clamoring to hear about their history in school, and they wouldn't give it to them. Those are some of the things that caused me to, that was my turning point, let's say. I used to walk with information, with some of the things that were the inventions that were invented by black people. And I'd have their sheets with me with the answers on the bottom. And when I rode the bus, I heard teenage children coming from school and arguing or talking about nonsense. I would go up to them and give them a couple of sheets and suggest that they read this and have a discussion. So that's something that I've been doing throughout the years. And I just look forward to the change. You mentioned the invention of the black race, a book. I'm trying to get that one. I'd also like to know if you have any information regarding the Jewish people. because in studying Hebrew, there is no J in the alphabet. So I was wondering if there's a book that gives the information as to how the Jews were invented. Do you know of any?
Well, there are a few, but they're not readily available. You actually have to go to some library and take a look at the history. In fact, this is one of the major things that is happening in Israel right now. The push by many Jews in Israel for the truth of their existence, because there are many activists who see this as being at the root of the problem of conflict, constant conflict in Israel, where in order to justify it's the same all over the world, where you have colonial powers, imperial powers. A lot is invested in creating a narrative that isn't necessarily true, but it is necessary to condition people's minds to accept their perspective as true. And these false narratives are now, I mean, there's a vigorous attempt to disassemble them and to glean what is the truth. I mean, when you have a country in modern times that says it is the land of the Jews, and that doesn't rattle the world when it's actually explained as the land of the Jews, and we see no effort in the scientific world to say, well, wait a minute, can you prove the lineage? How many of Israel's Jews today are directly descended from the historical Israelites and ancient Hebrews? Most everybody claiming dominance in Israel are of Ashkenazi affiliation, and that's Eastern European. The people who have been Jews for longer than their memory, who are black, have been at one time in recent years been made to reconvert to what the Ashkenazi dominated Jewish leadership is saying. This is the real Jew. This is the real Judaism. This is an extraordinary development, and we don't see and we don't regard this as startling as when we discuss South Africa. When we confronted apartheid. So it's a journey, and it's a very, very difficult journey, because the narrative is necessary to change long-standing historical fact about who are the Jews, who are the people of Israel. And they're saying this to negate the Palestinians, of course, to negate the existence of all these other cultures that had been there for centuries.
That's true.
And to give rise to this group. I mean, you think about it. The chosen people. Why would God...
Where in the world did that come from?
Why would God choose... above everybody, just select a group of people to say, he created all people, let's say. If we accept that, at least as the biblical narrative, God created everybody. Why would he now say it's okay that these people are special. They're the chosen ones. So there's a lot of difficulty in accepting these precepts, but and in understanding that they are necessary in order to create the predetermined outcome here. I must say, though, that there's vigorous opposition within Israel to all of these concepts. There are many Jews who find them absolutely reprehensible, and in the same way that people started waging that struggle in South Africa, they're doing it in Israel too. We don't see coverage of it, but I can assure you there are people who are saying this is not the way to go, this is not the way we want to live, and this is not what we embrace as a Jewish identity. These things are anathema to us, and we want a more just and full society. So that's a good part of it, that there's great resistance.
Okay. I'm sorry that I won't be able to get a hug or give a hug when you go
when
to
you
Manhattan.
When you get a verbal hug, you're giving me one, and I'm giving you one back.
Well, the funny thing about it is I live in Brooklyn, and I'm here in Florida on vacation.
Oh.
So I sent a letter to the church. You probably will not get it. They're going to forward it to you because I spoke to someone there. They'll forward it to you, and you'll see some questions that I have asked. And I hope to hear from you when you get back to Florida.
Thank you so much, Sonia, for your call. I'm sure I will get it, and you will hear from me. Thank you. Jose from Rosedale, you're on the air.
Greetings, my professor, and I might add my personal therapist. And I want to also wish you a very, very progressive Women's History Month.
Thank you.
May the God of our ancestors continue to shower down their blessings upon you. All right?
Thank you so much for that. I appreciate that very deeply.
You're welcome. Now, I was listening a little bit yesterday. I was in class a little bit, but I had to run here and there. So I really wasn't fully in class yesterday. But I heard a little of what you were discussing yesterday about this situation here in this country and what one could do to make a difference or make a change, some of that you're discussing?
Yes.
Good. Now, I, as an elder, being in this world for quite a few decades, I have come to the realization a long time ago that, especially in this country, it's the triplets that run this country and particularly runs the world is something that I don't know if most of the whites in America are prepared to confront. It is done piecemeal and so forth. And when I refer to the triplets, I'm referring to imperialism, capitalism, and white supremacy. They all go hand in hand. And most whites are not prepared to give up those powers. And so if there any changes, real changes are going to come in this country, I believe the white folks is going to really have to reach a point, the breaking point, where they come to the realization that these rascals that that runs this country and they spread their tentacles throughout the world, they have to come to the realization that they don't mean them any good, neither do they mean us any good. And I'm talking about Africans in America. And I want to say quickly that when I refer to, say, Africans in America, it includes all Africans. As long as you're on this soil, you are under the jurisdiction and the system that runs this place. We are totally in its control. So whether I just got here off the boat today, or yesterday, or last week, or you can trace your ancestry back to 10 and 20 generations back before the Mayflower and so forth, the system is there to keep all of us in check. So I just want to keep that in mind. Now, the other thing is, I think Mr. Garvey, he came up with a great plan, a GPS system for us as African people in this country and the world. And I think the powers that be who came down on this man and the UNI movement, ACL, and destroyed it. It was so sad. And many of our people were not able to take up the mantle of this great movement and take it through to its fullest. But there are some of us out there that are still trying, because right now I'm a member of the UNIA and we are doing some things out there. But I just want to use that as an example. That is one example that we as a people, we could use, right? The other one is, I remember when our great ancestor here that has left us and I just want to big her up too, because this is Women's History Month and this is a sister that we should never, ever forget. When the Democrats had their convention in Atlantic City, and that delegation from Mississippi, that all-white delegation who claimed they were representing Mississippi, where so many, the huge number of Africans are living there in Mississippi. And this all-white contingent wanted to be the representative for the Democratic Party. So both parties have been playing us like for suckers for a long time. But anyway, she said, hell no, this can't work. And she came up with a better representation of the state and went to the convention in Atlantic City and demanded to be seated. And many, Johnson and others were up in arms because they didn't know what to do. They had their delegation that it was considered the norm for white folks to represent black folks all the time. And this courageous, gallant sister said, no, it's not going to be this way. And they had a problem with trying to put her representatives in. And Johnson and others brought out all the big guns to try to convince this sister that she should step down and compromise. And as African people...
Put a name to the sister.
Beg your pardon? Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer. Good. Now, every step of the way, we as African people are always the ones that have to accept compromises that goes against our interests. Now, when they even call Congressman Adam Clayton Powell Jr. to try to convince this sister that she should back down, she should compromise and accept the crumbs that the Democratic Party was offering to the group. And she said, no. Congressman Powell had the nerve to ask this sister if she knew who he was. And she said to him, yes, I know who you are. But how many bales of cotton have you picked? And how many lashes have you taken, Congressman? And he couldn't answer. So the point I'm making is that she created the Mississippi Democratic Freedom Party. And I think the way we should have gone as African people in this country is to create our own political system. And we stick together in a solid base. And let the rascals come to us when they find that our vote is going to matter. And we have credible, respectable, courageous leadership that is going to negotiate on our behalf. And not the compromises that these rascals have been doing on behalf of African people. And the same thing that has happened in South Africa, in the Caribbean, all over the place. We have rascals there looking like us that claim that they're there to represent our interests. And all they're doing is representing the interests of their masters. And in South Africa right now, the system of apartheid is alive and well. And African people at home and abroad is going to have to fight that system. There's going to be a racial war in South Africa. We can kiss up to the whites all we want to. We can compromise all we want to. But blood is going to have to be shed because the white people have no intention of being fair and honest and decent. They believe that they must be in charge. They must have total power over African people and the people of color. And if we are too coward and too punkish to stand up and to fight them, there is no other way we are going to gain any kind of freedom and justice in this society, here and abroad. It's not going
to
happen.
I want to ask you this. Do you think that African people have done what they were supposed to do to keep their leadership in check? And it is one thing to say, well, the white power structure, the white supremacist structure, mm-hmm. is taking its toll. Well, what else do you expect? That's what they aimed to do. That's what they were designed to do.
Yes.
But we have had time and again, and I go back to your reference of Fannie Lou Hamer,
mm-hmm.
out of Fannie Lou Hamer's effort
mm-hmm.
came one Jesse Jackson. You know, directly out of that effort came the possibility of Jesse Jackson, and mm-hmm. he inherited the path that was cleared for him by Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
Now, has the black community held Jesse Jackson's feet to the fire? No.
No.
Everybody has walked away and refused to say, listen, you have some accounting to do.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the problem that we have. Not so much. I mean, we kind of have an idea of our relationship with a power structure,
mm-hmm.
but we don't see many examples in mm-hmm. which black people are punishing, mm-hmm. exposing and punishing those who betray us.
You know, my professor, we have been besieged and beset by charlatans throughout our history. And we don't have conscious leadership. Most of the leadership we have had has not been conscious leadership. And I thought also, as you said, the follower. We don't have enough conscious followers to keep those people's feet to the fire. You know, I read some of a couple of months ago in Brooklyn at an event where a politician was trying to sell the community on the robbery of the Bedford Armory, right? And I told him at the meeting that the die has been cast, the deal is done, and when they have these so-called political town hall meetings, it is merely to manipulate and maneuver the crumbs. All the whole loaf of the bread is already gone. But the crumbs, they call you two little groups to come together in the community and make believe that we are still in the race and that will matter. It is really to manipulate the crumbs. And I told the audience, I said the reason why these political leaders feel that they can sell us out and come before us with no fear or nothing is because they have no fear of us. I said, if we would tar and sever them and run them not only out of this town, but out of this world when they sell us out and come against us. I was surprised to see that a few weeks after that, there was another meeting and I was there and the politician came over to me and called me on the side and asked me, what did I mean by saying that our leaders sell us out, there should be tar and feather? And I asked the person, what do you think tar and feathering mean? I said, do you understand the history of tar? What you do to someone when you tar and feather them? So they asking me this silly question. And that's the problem with our leadership. They have no fear
of
us.
The problem is, refocus your argument, because
yes.
We hear, and it is a very easy thing to point fingers and say, well, the leadership is failing. when we should actually reorient our thinking, it is not the leadership that's failing. We are failing. We are failing by neglecting to hold these elected officials to account. We just have totally absolved ourselves of that responsibility. And naturally, this is politics, and politics is about being pragmatic in one's own interest for the most part, and that's what they do. So the issue, and I understand your passion about it, I share it, but I also lament the fact that people choose to do nothing. They choose to do nothing, but they expect to get a different result. We can't have that.
Yes.
People have to understand that this too, being a steward of your own political future, is your job.
Yes.
And when you neglect it,
to understand what is in their interest. As an individual, when you go to these events and you voice your concern and you ask the credible and pertinent questions, some of the same folks you're fighting for look at you as if you're a pariah.
And this is my point. Why are we not changing? Why are we not changing our tactics? Our tactics should say it is no longer practical to confront them in an open forum. It is more practical to organize against them. That's where the work needs to be done. You have to organize. Kwame Ture says it all the time. You have to be organized people in order to get the effect of leadership that you want. We keep begging people to do the right thing. That doesn't work. We keep asking them nicely. That doesn't work. You have to organize against them. So when you walk into a room, they see 400 other people. And that's what we do not want to do. We don't take the initiative of organizing our community, which is a reflection of the discipline in our community. And this is one of the things that Garvey proved. He wasn't just talking to a system. He was building an alternative system, which required discipline and organization. We're not up to that. We just don't see the need to do that much work. But we want the results. And that is the eternal problem that we have. At some point, we have to accept 100% responsibility for abrogating our own responsibility and causing this much havoc that inevitably is going to be directed at us. Thanks so much for calling today.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Marie from Baltimore, you're on the air.
Taking my call, and you're above earth and kicking and talking. I like what you said to the caller, that we have to do something to make changes. And I'm calling in reference to last week. I meant to say something about certain people who feel they want to be in power by changing someone else, not of their race, for their convenience. In other words, change me to make them happy. And I'm sorry I wasn't able to say that. And I know somebody from the Midwest, she felt the same way about these, what do you call them, certain Jewish married women who want to have power over the black race. I'm sorry I have to say that. But I'm going on to something else. There is a movie out right now called Shaka Zulu, not the one that played back in the 1980s. I think it's a better film. I think it's educational. And it's a rough and deep thought film that's out, that's showing in Baltimore every Sunday. That's all I have to say, and Latisse, you keep on preaching. You are also a preacher, whether you know that or not.
I appreciate that. All right. Okay, now.
All right, dear. Take care.
Thank you so much for your call today. Jean from Maryland, you're on the air.
Hi, Eutrice. Good Friday afternoon to you and to the PRN Lead Stories family.
Thank you so much. Thank you, and the same to you.
Thank you. I came to a very startling discovery this week. I have a very bright 9-year-old daughter who reads, writes well above grade level. And she sat for the PARC test about a month and a half ago. And the scores came in this week. And when the scores came, they read that she tested in the 32nd percentile. Now, her classroom performance, she has a 3.9 grade point average. How can this child possibly test in the 32nd percentile? So my wife and I are reviewing now what is actually being tested on the PARC test. And it turns out that they're not really testing to see whether or not your child can read and write. They're testing to see whether or not your child can take the test. And that is interesting in that this is the benchmark that is used to determine whether or not a school system is doing its job in educating children. And I wanted to ask you, A, have you dug into this at all? And if you would take a look at the website when you have a chance, parcc.pearson.com. And there's a practice section there where you can actually take a test and you'll see what is being requested of a test taker. And then if you could have a guest who can talk a little bit about some of the differences between the test and the curriculum and why.
Well, you're raising a long-standing issue concerning testing. First of all, we ought to understand that educational services are systems. Their job, they have a job. Their job is to prepare the future generation for whatever it is that they think the future generation ought to be equipped to do. Now, by reasoning, given our history, we know that it is not expected that all children should perform equally. So the educational systems don't deliver equal education. That was the whole thing about Brown versus Board of Education of 1957. Your child was never intended to have the same educational opportunities and the same education as a white child. So the tests are skewed in a way to produce a result that would show lower performance, lower skills, lower aptitudes in children of color, generally across the board, as opposed to white children. This is their world. And we are simply asking to participate in it. And the answer is no. But they wouldn't say that as blatantly as that. They will go through the motions of saying, look, everybody got the same test, everybody had the same courses and so forth. It's just that your child doesn't understand it, that the ability of the child to internalize and grasp certain concepts. Look, I had a niece going to Boston University. And she had a course. It was a very annoying course to her. And I used to go up all the time to check on how she was doing in school. And then it came to the point where she was in danger of failing a course. But I was teaching her differently. She was getting the answers. But then she was threatened with a failure, a D in the course. And the professor, I kid you not, the professor's explanation was, when I confronted it, she was getting the right answers, but he wasn't sure she was getting the concepts. Now, is that stupid or what? What he was actually saying was he couldn't figure out how it was possible that she could get the answers without using his methods. Because the course was, in fact, skewed against students of color. No question about it, in my mind. So this went all the way to the president. Explain to me how a person could get the right answers and still be held accountable for not getting the right concepts, when, in fact, to get the right answers, you ought to have the right concepts, except I'm teaching an entirely different concept, which delivers the right answers. I'll go back and give you another example. As you know, I was born in Trinidad, and I was literate. I could read, and I could kind of write by the age of 2. This was not because I was especially brilliant. It was because this was the expectation. We had a little old rickety school, nothing much that you could boast about. But you are not going to be sitting around the house going, mama, dada, baba. You are to be literate by the age of 2. That was the goal. And Mrs. Waterman would make sure you are literate by the age of 2. Every child. So we had an entirely different approach, an entirely different concept. And instead, if I were to come, as I did eventually, to the United States, I was totally misdiagnosed, completely sidelined, because, again, I'm getting the right answers, but they just don't understand the concept. I'm saying to you that you have to expect this of a system that intends to deliver unequal education. This is part of your duty as a parent. And it goes beyond what the school is saying. Never mind what the school is saying. You should start out with the premise that your child is at risk from day one in any educational system that you and others don't design. You cannot expect the standardized tests, and this is really what testing is. It has nothing to do with measuring intelligence and capacity for learning and performing. None of those things are part of the curriculum. It is about how your child is seen as performing on these standardized tests that are riddled with cultural and racist biases. You just said your child is, she performs very well in school. But the test, it's the invisible barrier here. The test has nothing to do with her capacity for learning and performance.
Or what's being taught.
It's exactly
that.
So the challenge here is to get her some extra help. And you yourself, you'll have to go through some learning about what testing has become and what testing serves, the purpose it serves is not really to ascertain the capacity of the child, but it operates on the premise that your child is deficient. That's from the start. And it becomes a, testing becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If your child is deficient, there should be no surprise when the results come in and the child is deficient. Not the teaching methods being inadequate, not the educational services being lopsided and racist and biased, not anything having to do with the test. The test is the means by which future generations will be culled. They will be selected to be outside of the herd. They're being conditioned to be second-class citizens. My little scoop. I didn't even have a book. I have a piece of a slate. And we didn't care. This is what we knew. But I tell you, you will have one heck of a challenge finding teachers like Mrs. Waterman and Mrs. King and Mrs. Bowron and so forth, and Mr. Brown. They did not play. They were serious about education, and that's why you perform. And I think it's a good opportunity for you to think about these things and to look to finding the appropriate environment for your child to develop and to excel. I believe all children can excel and should excel, but systems fail them. So think about that. What can you do? What you and your wife, what can you both do to shore up the chances of success for your child? And to invest directly as parents. When I say invest, I don't mean, you know, you go hire a tutor and all of this kind of stuff, but work on the idea that your child is brilliant, just as she is. She has great potential, and what she needs more than anything else is a defense system. Thanks so much for calling. Again, I hope to see you on Sunday at the community church on Avenue. Just talk to each other again on